Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. And my guest today is Molly McCulley-Brown. A writer, poet and essayist, Brown has been the recipient of a number of prestigious scholarships, including the Amy Lowell Poetry Travelling Scholarship and a United States Artist Fellowship. Her works featured across a variety of high-profile publications, including the Paris Review, the New York Times and the Yale Review. Raised in rural Virginia, she now lives in Gamba, Ohio, where she's the Kenyon Review Fellow in Poetry at Kenyon College. Her latest book is an essay collection titled Places I've Taken My Body. Molly, thanks so much for joining us here on Monocle Reads.
Thank you for having me.
So in this collection of 17 intimate and incisive essays, you explore living within and really beyond the limits of a body. In your case, one shaped since birth by cerebral palsy, which is a permanent and often painful movement disorder. And I wondered if we could just start with that for you to explain to us exactly what cerebral palsy is.
Sure. So cerebral palsy is a neurological disorder that's commonly caused by oxygen deprivation, either during or immediately after birth. It's a little like having a stroke immediately after you were born. I was born at 29 weeks and I weighed only 2 pounds. And essentially what it means for me, cerebral palsy has a huge range of presentations depending on the extent and the nature of the brain damage. But what it means for me is that my muscle tone is really high and my balance is really poor. So I can walk, but only a little bit. And I mostly use a wheelchair to get around. And my muscles are just really spastic and really contracted, especially in the lower part of my body and my legs.
And are you in pain?
Often the brain damage itself doesn't cause pain, but the high spasticity is painful and it causes a gait that puts a lot of pressure on your joints in a way that wears away on cartilage and often hurts.
Mm. So how do those physical limitations and the pain affect not the content, but the process of your writing?
So, I mean, the most obvious answer is that I don't write by hand. It's difficult for me to write more than a little bit by hand because of the spasticity in my hands. And so I write on a computer, but that's pretty much the only way that it affects the process of what I do. Although I think the kind of the way that I pay attention and move through the world is shot through my writing in all kinds of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder how your relationship with your body has changed over the years.
In some ways, I think it's probably changed in many of the same ways that many women's relationships with their bodies sort of change and shift as they get older. But I think that one of the things that can be complicated about growing up with a disability from very early childhood is that you grow up being told from your earliest moments that your body is a thing that is somehow wrong or broken and needs fixing, right? And in one way, it very much does. There are things that are painful about it or that make mobility difficult that can sometimes be helped in certain ways by surgical or orthopedic or medical interventions, but are never going to, you know, are never going to be totally fixed. And here I'm using quotation marks because that's such a complicated framework, but I think it can be complicated to have your relationship with your body from your earliest moments be one that understands it as this broken thing or this marred thing or this insufficient thing. And I think for me, a lot of coming into an adult relationship with my body has been learning to make that relationship a little more nuanced and a little more complicated and understand my body not only as this thing, which is, yes, sometimes difficult or painful for me, but also as a thing which is constitutive of who I am and how I think about the world and how I move through it, and which has given me as many things as it has taken or made complicated.
Yes, because in your essay collection, Places I've Taken My Body, one gets the sense of gratitude and celebration.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing, right? Is we're all embodied people, which means we live our entire lives in our bodies. And it's true that for me, that has sometimes meant difficulty. It has sometimes meant hospital stays. It has sometimes meant surgeries or pain or places that I can't access or things that I can't do that I wish I could. But it's also meant that I live all the other pieces of my life in my body. I live the relationships that matter to me most. I live the joy I take in beautiful things in the world. I live my connections with other people. I live, the food that I love and the books that I love. All of that belongs to my body just as much as any of the rest of it. And I am enormously grateful for that.
Before we get on to the book itself, I just want to examine slightly that crossover between poetry and whatever you would call this. I don't know if you'd call it memoir.
Yeah, I mean it is a memoir. It's a memoir in essays, so it's not a single sustained narrative, but it is a sort of record of pieces of my life, and in that way it is a memoir. And I think in some ways, poets make natural nonfiction writers because both I think are a matter of paying careful and complex attention to the world. And I hope that my life as a poet and my work as a poet, makes me more aware of wonderful writing on the sentence level and makes me more aware of how you construct a moving image and of the work that sound can do in a book. And I think that that's, those are skills that are applicable across genres.
So this particular work came out of a fellowship. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the bulk of this book, or at least more than half of it, was written during the year that I spent traveling abroad on the Amy Lowell Poetry Traveling Scholarship. And that's a wonderful scholarship funded by the estate of the poet Amy Lowell, which is designed to give one American writer a year of funded travel abroad, in which they have no other responsibilities other than to travel and to write. But the prize itself has a relatively intense stipulation, which is that when you leave the country at the beginning of the scholarship year, you're not permitted to return to America for any reason for the balance of the scholarship year. And it's a wonderful and incredible thing. But it was also, especially in my body, a relatively difficult year. I was living alone in unfamiliar territory in spaces that were often not very accessible and without the sort of community resources that I have in my usual life. And it was both sort of, I felt incredibly lucky and incredibly grateful to be able to experience so much of the world and to have this time. And I also struggled and I felt frustrated by the ways in which my body limited access to many of these spaces. And I worried that I was taking the opportunity away from a writer who might be able to make more expansive use of the time because they were less limited by their body. And I had to really encounter and re-encounter my relationship with my own body and its history and with my own mobility and with how that affected both my living and my writing life. And about half of the book really takes up that year and those concerns kind of in real time.
I mean, Bologna was a particularly difficult place for you. You had an unfamiliar language. Of course, the streets there cobbled, access very hard.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and that was a particularly painful place for me to be, not only because it was so hard to get around logistically, which it was, but also because I love so many things about that city so much. It's an incredibly beautiful place to be. It's an incredibly lively place to be. There's a real sense of magic in the way the light hits that city. And I loved it very much. And I also found it incredibly difficult to be there. And that tension, I think, was actually what produced the sort of most difficulty for me. What does it mean to be shut out of this place that you love and admire and want so much to be able to access?
Now, religion is a constant throughout the book, and I wonder how important it is for you when in a new environment to at least have this as a constant, and what your relationship with religion is.
Yeah, so I describe myself as a sort of, continually questioning and troubled and conflicted Catholic convert. And I think that's a pretty accurate description of my relationship to religion. I wasn't raised with any particular intense religious observance, but I had a real attachment to faith and an interest in theology from my earliest moments. I think some of that comes with sort of trying to parse out my relationship to my body and the sort of intentionality of that and what it means to have been born in a body like mine. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that I was, am an identical twin. We were both born very early and she unfortunately did not survive. She died a couple of days after we were born. And I think having this person who you both feel you know and also don't know, and this figure who has been both missing and present from the earliest moments of your life, it gives you sort of no choice but to believe in and be invested in something beyond the world that we are inhabiting, even if that relationship is you know, sometimes marked by mystery and gratitude and loveliness, and sometimes marked by anger and sadness and frustration, and sometimes marked by absence and doubt. But it's been very much a sort of a part of my life for as long as I can remember.
It's an incredibly generous book. You really allow us into your inner workings, if you like. And I was particularly fascinated in your writing on desire. And I wondered if you could talk to us a bit about that.
Yeah, so I hit on this a little bit when I was talking earlier in our conversation about my relationship to my body. But one of the complexities of growing up with a disability that requires sort of constant medical intervention is that you have a very medicalized relationship to your body. You're a patient, right? And your physical experience of being in the world is one of intervention and error and pain. And it's particularly difficult if you combine that with a body that often does put you in physical pain to figure out, oh, how do I have a relationship to my body that's also about pleasure and desire and intimacy and connection? And that gets doubly difficult if you live in a society, as I think we do, that is often sort of primed to see people with disabilities, disabled people, as sexless or infantile or without desire. And I think navigating that complexity, both of my own individual relationship to my body as a site of connection and intimacy and pleasure and desire, and of also how to grapple with building that sense of myself in a society that sometimes made that very difficult, is something that I'm really interested in. And it's particularly at the root of one essay in the book, but I think it's really shot through a lot of its concerns in all kinds of ways.
I mean, you've written about, you know, how people approach and go, oh, but you're so pretty. Why are you in a wheelchair? What happened?
Yeah, I think we have this strange notion that you know, disability is something that only belongs to elderly people, or that it somehow, if you are young or feminine or you know, attractive in some way to anyone, that's somehow like inappropriate or wrong, or that there's something particularly awful about the collision of those things, when in fact that's a sort of absurd and really damaging notion.
So there's this great kind of internal examination that goes on in the book, but there's also an external description and exploration of all of these wonderful places. So, for instance, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is one topic you look at. You look at the world's oldest anatomical theatre. Tell us about some of those geographical highlights.
Yeah, I mean, so it's one of the kind of funny contradictions of my life that both in and even beyond this year that I spent on the Amy Lowell, I've lived a very sort of peripatetic life, even though I live in this body that makes motion fraught or difficult. And I've lived in and loved and traveled through a lot of landscapes, both literal landscapes and also just textual and historical landscapes. And so it was really important to me that the book not be this kind of myopic and inwardly turned text, but it be a text that was invested in all the ways that I am invested in the world and all of the sort of remarkable terrain that exists there. And for me, Frankenstein is a text that's mattered to me in all kinds of different ways since I was a very young person. And it's a text that I carried with me into many of these cities. And one of the reasons I was drawn to Bologna in the first place is because Bologna's medical school is the oldest medical school in the West. And the anatomical theater that's there is one of the earliest anatomical theaters in the world. And so it's the place where human anatomy, as we understand it, and surgery, as we understand it, was born and came to be. And that understanding of the human body and of how we go in and cut and change and, you know, correct error in the human body is a field that has marked my entire life. It's marked the shape of my body and the shape of my existence. And so to be able to go and travel to that place and explore its history and be in that physical space was really powerful. And it's one of the things that made the fact that the city was so inaccessible feels so complicated and so painful. What does it mean to be unable to access the very spaces that in some ways feel like they're the spaces that made you, right? Mm. That your body is a consequence of.
Another place you talk about is Jerry Falwell's Liberty University.
Liberty University is an evangelical Christian university in the United States in Virginia, and it's located only a few miles from where I was raised. And evangelical Christianity in America is an incredibly culturally conservative religion. And it's a religion that I grew up with a moral code that I had a really sort of bad association and honestly, frankly, continue to have a bad association with evangelical Christianity as this incredibly culturally conservative, anti-intellectual, bigoted force in American politics and in the world. And Liberty University is particularly true in the leadership at Liberty, which is often sort of in the high echelons of very, very conservative politics in America. And it was complicated to be so interested in religion and so moved by so much about faith and theology and also have the sort of religious institution in my backyard be this really damaging force in the world. But obviously, no faith, no school of faith, and even no single institution is as simple as one monolith or one person or one conviction. And so one of the things that I wanted to do in the book in exploring my own relationship with faith is sort of take a closer look at Liberty, but also at the way that evangelicals had or hadn't made their peace with Donald Trump and with what felt to me like a particularly damaging and damning chapter of American politics.
Mm. I mean, you talk about how you encourage your students to be invested in the complexity and value of an existence that looks nothing like your own. And I guess we could be talking Trumpism here in the Great American Divide.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think that you know, failing to be invested in the complexity and the humanity and the dignity of lives that look nothing like his own is one of Trump's major failures among many. But paradoxically, it's also the thing that I think those of us who, you know, feel so like we've sort of watched in horror for so many years as this particular kind of conservatism have taken over, have to keep in mind so that we continue to have complex and nuanced relationship with the forces that have made that possible in America, not to excuse it, but to correct it and to prevent it from ever happening again.
In the pandemic, you've published not one, but two books. And I wonder what it is that drives you. I mean, there's another wonderful quote from the book: chronic pain makes you good at abandoning yourself. It teaches you that your body is a thing to ignore until it insists on being noticed. And I wonder if that pain in any way was a motivating factor.
Well, I don't know that it's quite as simple as pain being a motivating factor, but I can certainly tell you that one of my favorite lines of poetry in the world is a line by the poet Louise Glick that comes from a poem called The Hawthorn Tree. It's in a beautiful book called The Wild Iris that's written from the point of view actually of many plants in a garden, which sounds kind of hokey, but is actually in fact quite wonderful. And the line in this poem, which is told from the perspective of this hawthorn tree, goes, "Things that can't move, learn to see. I do not need to chase you through the garden." And I do think that there's something about the slowness and the difficulty with which I have often had to move through the world that has lent me a different kind of attention and certainly a different kind of investment in what it means to articulate what I can see. And, you know, there are so many things in my life that I from my earliest moments did not feel built for, including the sort of most basic kinds of motion through the world. But a thing that I have always felt built for is the writing life and a relationship with language. I've been, you know, not only a writer, but a grateful and devoted reader for my entire life. And I think that absolutely, you know, spurs and shapes my writing life. And is a huge part of why the page is where I go in both the wonderful moments and the difficult ones.
Molly, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Places I've Taken My Body by Molly McCully Brown is published by Faber and Faber, and it's out now. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the producer Nora Hull and researcher Charlie Filmer-Court. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.